Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument in Johnson versus City of Houston.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent, at this point, Rosie Hunks. Leona Johnson died within the last couple of months.
Sorry, you represent whom?
Rosie Hunks, Your Honor. I need to explain.
Yes, sir.
How far this goes back. Yes. I'm not sure how familiar the court is with the underlying facts. But
pretty familiar with them. We're pretty familiar, but if someone has passed away, why?
Your Honor, the point is that I'm here representing the heirs of the estate, and I'll just jump right on through it then.
And you say that Rosie Monks has since died?
Is a sister.
And she's died?
No. No, Leona Johnson has died.
All right. Forget it.
Rosie Monks is the only surviving
heir. That's correct,
heir. Your
Honor.
Is that correct?
The family is being whittled down as this case goes along. The wrongful death statute, you'll have to pardon me, I keep calling the Wrongful Death Act, and wanted to tell the appellate court, inform me in their opinion that you call it the Wrongful Death Statute, provides that the spouse, children, and parents of a decedent under the act have a right to bring cause of action against the person who caused that death. The damages that are considered under the Wrongful Death Statute include pecuniary losses, loss of consortium, mental anguish. Those are the pertinent damages before the court today. The survival statute basically holds that in a case where a person has personal injuries as a result of the conduct of another, those personal injuries vest in that person's estate upon the death of that person, and their estate may maintain that cause of action. The reason for the wrongful death statute and the survival statute was to avoid the harsh common law rule that when the plaintiff dies, the plaintiff's claims die with her. That brings us to the issue that the court must decide in this case, and that is whether or not a cause of action under the Wrongful Death Act survives the death of a proper beneficiary. The damages under the Wrongful Death Statute are personal injury type damages, particularly loss of consortium and mental anguish damages. The plain language of the survival statute allows a party or a person to their estate to maintain a cause of action when they die before they can conclude that cause of action against the party that caused the damages. Now, I've read the Huntington case, and I've read the other cases, Carter Van Meter, and those courts just say that the survival statute doesn't say that. That's what those courts say. They read the statute, and they say it doesn't say that. I've read every survival statute promulgated by the Texas legislature since 1895. And my question that I pose to those courts in this court today is, why not? Where in the plain language of the survival statute are those kinds of damages disallowed? This case really comes down to this court's holding. It's on my brief on page 6. Under Article 4677 of the Wrongful Death Statute, I'm going to read the second sentence. The amount so recovered shall be divided among the persons entitled to the benefit of the action or such of them as shall then be alive.
That seems to cut against you.
Your Honor, that is the crux, isn't it? Herein lies the rub. The entire point of my argument today and the gist of my brief is that a restrictive construction of that language will, in fact, deny Irene Preston a trial on the merits in this case.
Not a, the very literal term, the very literal word that you just read, as Justice Heck points out, cuts against it. There's nothing to construe. The very text that you just read.
Your Honor, I see the word or in that sentence as disjunctive, where it says, or such of them as shall be alive. Why put that sentence in there? Why distinguish between persons entitled or persons alive? Furthermore, when you look at the purpose of the law and you look at the survival statute, the purpose of the survival statute, the you can give the character of persons entitled any number of meanings. Does that mean the heirs, the legal representatives, or does it just mean the estate? But that is, that's what this court is going to have to decide. That sentence right there will turn this case. There's nothing in the survival statute that is going, that disallows this kind of cause of action.
It certainly does not allow it, the survival statute.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
You say there's nothing in the survival statute that disallows your position here. Is there anything in the survival statute that allows it?
Your Honor?
Or is it your position that it's just silent on the subject?
Well, Your Honor, what it says is, and this is the 1925 version of the survival statute, which was codified and, by the way, changed against the instructions of the codification not to change the substantive law. The substantive law underlying the codification says, causes of action upon which suit has been or may hereafter be brought for personal injuries or injuries resulting in death. Now, there's nothing in that sentence that says that the personal injuries suffered by Irene Preston are not of the character that can survive to her estate.
Let's go back to the wrongful death statute, to the 1986 codification of 71.010. If that is a non-substantive codification, how come, doesn't that indicate the intent of the legislature in 4677?
Not according to the instructions in the preface, Your Honor, because they were not to make substantive changes.
Well, I know that. So why doesn't that indicate that's what the law was all along, and that was the intent of the legislature? That's what bothers me.
Your Honor, it's the tradition, not the law. A tradition was established in the area of wrongful death. It goes back to the Fleming case, which is cited in the briefs. The Fleming case was a wrongful death case that was prior to the survival statute. And that was really the seed that began the court saying that these cases, that the cause of action did not survive the death of the beneficiary. It is also important to note, and I noted in my brief, that in the Fleming case, the statute being construed at that time said that specifically that if the sole plaintiff dies pending the suit, then the suit shall abate. And critically, the legislature withdrew that language in 1925.
Do you know if 1925 was a supposedly non-substantive codification? Because that was not a new law the legislature actually passed. Only that was a revised. That was when there was a revised civil code, a statute book put out.
Your Honor, I tried to figure that out, and I'll be honest with you, the mustier the books get, the harder it is for me to understand. And I did spend some time smelling some musty books in this case. But it was my understanding that was a substantive change in the fact that they completely dropped that article, and the remainder of the statute stayed the same. The point I was going to make is that this court is charged by the legislature to liberally construe these laws. The legislature further directs the court to look at the old law, look at the evil, and look at the remedy. And the case at hand is the perfect reason why this law should be liberally construed to allow Irene Preston to move forward. And that's because if she is not allowed, then the city, because of fortuitous events, that is the death of the plaintiff, is allowed to avoid a cause of action on the merits of the case. That is exactly what the legislature, in all its wisdom, intended to change back in 1860. It is also what the legislature intended to change in 1895 when they enacted the survival statute. And I think most importantly, by 1925, the full evolution of the two statutes had evolved. We would pray that the court reversed both the trial court and the appellate court, and most importantly, a wrong-minded legal tradition.
If we rule in your favor, do we just have to, we have to say that 71.010 was an improper codification of the law. Is that correct? I mean, if that's the law, then we have to affirm. Is that right?
If that is the law, Your Honor, and as I've said in my brief, it's not the substantive law. It's a wrong thought law or statement of the law. But that's exactly right.
I mean, we have to face what the legislature meant when they said no substantive change in the law.
Yes.
We have to then determine that the law was to the contrary prior to 1985 or 86, and then determine that 71.010 was a change in the law, and therefore strike 71.010 down. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I see it as primarily a publishing problem for the people who wrote that book.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
Yes, please, the court. Your Honor, this respondent will be represented by Ms. Barbara Bowman.
May it please the court. My name is Barbara Bowman. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Houston. City of Houston, as respondent, as defendant, and appellee, urges this court not to set aside over 100 years of case law. The city also urges this court, as has been pointed out by the justices, not to ignore the clear, unambiguous language of the Wrongful Death Act. You have in front of you a copy of the most recent codification of the Wrongful Death Act. To address your concerns, your most recent concerns, in 71.010, in the apportionment of damages, the phrase entitled to recover and who are alive at the time has been in the Wrongful Death Act since 1879. It is not a new statute. It is not a new article to the Wrongful Death Act. When Irene Preston, the sole surviving spouse of Mr. Preston, filed suit against the City of Houston, she filed in her own behalf.
Is that in that exact language, or is this, are you saying this is a non-substantive change of 4677, or such of them as shall then be allowed?
That is correct. I'm saying it is a non-substantive change, Your Honor.
All right, excuse me.
Ms. Preston filed suit on her own behalf under the Wrongful Death Act as the sole remaining beneficiary. She also filed suit on behalf of her husband, Alonzo Preston, as the legal representative of his estate. When she died, prior to this case going to trial, her two sisters, the sister-in-laws of the decedent, were substituted in as plaintiffs. Today, we found out that one of those sisters are also deceased. No one was ever substituted in as the representative, the legal representative, or the heir for Mr. Preston. Therefore, the petitioners in this case have basically abandoned any kind of survival statute or survival action as to the original decedent, Mr. Preston. Therefore, we're just looking at the Wrongful Death Act. And you'll notice the application of the Wrongful Death Act, those who are to be able to bring this cause of action. The obvious intent of the legislators were to provide for those that were closest to the person, to the deceased, the one actually suffering the injuries. This wrongful death action is for the exclusive benefit of the surviving spouse, children, and parents. Mrs. Preston was the only person entitled under this statute and under the clear language of the statute to bring her cause of action. By allowing the petitioners in this case to continue with this cause of action, this wrongful death cause of action, this court would have to be redrafting the law as it stands today. In addition, this court would be expanding the list of exclusive beneficiaries to include a sister-in-law, which the law clearly does not permit. In addition, this court would have to ignore the clear language of 71.010, which has been in effect since 1879. The legislature...
Don't you agree this is a little different than 4677?
Excuse me, Ron.
Isn't this a little different than 4177, which had a disjunctive or in it?
Yes, Your Honor. The language a lot. I'm sorry.
An or has been substituted for an and. We now have an and rather than an or, just for openers.
The point being that alive at the time, that particular wording has been in. That
now
has not changed.
Now it says and it used to be or, correct?
I don't know that to be a fact. I will take Mr. Fontibert's word for that. I don't know that to be a fact. The language that was dropped, if the sole plaintiff dies pending the suit, in that language, that seems to me to be repetitive of alive at the time. If that phrase is referring to the Wrongful Death Act and not the survival statute, then the language is basically repetitive and was dropped for that reason. The survival statute that you have in front of you on the bottom portion of the page is the present survival statute, and it is the interpretation that has been given to the survival statute since common law and continues today. It's Alonzo Preston's injury, his losses, his personal injuries.
There's nothing on the face of the statute that says it has to be Alonzo Preston.
No, it
you
doesn't.
You just put that in
the
there.
Interpretation, that's there's correct, Your Honor. The interpretation since common law has been the person, because the damages are different. The damages would be from his estate, the funeral expenses, the medical expenses, his personal pain and suffering. Through case law over 100 years, that's what the interpretation of the survival action has been.
But other than one writ refused, our court has never passed it.
That is correct in this specific instance. Admittedly, the Texas position that the cause of action abates at the time of the sole beneficiary's death is a minority position. The other statutes throughout the country who hold the way Texas do not have the language alive at the time, but they do have very specific language in their statutes that state the cause of action is not to continue for the sole benefit of benefiting the estate for the next statutory beneficiary to inherit. The focus of all the jurisdictions that agree with Texas is that the most closely related relatives, next of kin, are those who should benefit under the wrongful death. The more remote inheritant people are not to benefit from the Wrongful Death Act. The jurisdictions that hold opposite of Texas have very clear and very specific language in their statutes that says the wrongful death action does not abate at the time of the death of the beneficiary, but would be inherited or go to the estate of the beneficiary. That language is very, very clear in their statutes. That language is totally missing in the Texas statute. There's no jurisdiction that I've been able to find that specifically has held or states that the survival statute is or should be applied to the Wrongful Death Act or to any other act, cause of action. I believe that if the court grants the petitioner's wishes at this point, that we would be opening the floodgates. We would be instituting a new cause of action, and we would also be opening the floodgates to apply the survival statute to any other statutory cause of action. Plaintiffs could certainly argue at that point it could be applied to a DTPA suit. It could be applied to a workers' compensation death benefit suit. I'm not sure, I'm fairly certain that the court system within the state of Texas could not afford that kind of litigation. The court system is already clogged. And in order to, by applying the survival statute, a cause of action would have no end point. It would go on and be passed down from one generation to a next generation.
You're assuming nothing ever gets tried in our state. A few things do.
Yes, Your Honor, some things do, and some things do get settled.
Like 300,000 cases of civil, non-family law cases a year in the district courts of the state are somehow resolved, and once they're resolved, then the appeal process becomes final.
But if the survival...
You don't have this argument.
But if the survival statute applies to actions now that are not inherited, do not go down through descent and distribution, and that law is changed, then that would logically increase the number of cases that would be filed. They would have that cause of action, and they could file that cause of action if the beneficiary
it's
had.
It's your position that enough people will, that'll happen enough people will do it. If we rule this way, our system will collapse.
I'm not sure our system could stand up under it. And I'm not sure there's any equity in that. The city of Houston still had possible liability as to the survival action on behalf of the original plaintiff or the decedent, Alonzo Preston. The city still had that liability out there had the petitioners decided to continue with that cause of action. The city wasn't getting off scot-free. There are not any inequities in this case because the person who should benefit, the persons who has suffered the losses, are Ms. Preston, and she is no longer with us.
You're not saying, are you, that had the survival action wrongful death suit been reduced to judgment, that if the beneficiaries had then died, that any judgment would not be inherited by heirs of that estate?
No. The cases are fairly clear that once it has gone to judgment, then the beneficiary's estate would be entitled to that. But
why is this different from that?
Well, because the Ms. Preston's suit, the Wrongful Death Act, is sheerly derivative of the survival statute. And at that point in time, the facts would have been tried. We would have known the city could have used the same defenses against Ms. Preston's cause of action as they would have against Mr. Preston's contributory negligence, statute of limitations, whatever. At that point, the city would have been found liable for his injuries. Therefore, once judgment is entered, we would be liable for the damages awarded.
Should the court be concerned at all with the difficulties of proof in asserting an inherited cause of action under the survival statute or wrongful death act?
But for the survival statute, the wrongful death act wouldn't exist, or the wrongful death cause of action wouldn't exist. So to that end, I guess there does have to be some concern about proving, that the city was liable for Mr. Preston's injury.
Well, I was thinking more in the nature of the damages that would occur to the statutory beneficiaries and the difficulty of the person who inherits that cause of action of proving what damages would have been sustained had that person lived
yes,
and been able to assert them in front of a jury.
assuming that maybe no depositions had been taken or whatever of the beneficiary prior to death, I think it would be difficult to prove. In conclusion, there isn't any reason, there's no equitable reason, there's no logical reason for this court to apply the survival statute to the Wrongful Death Act. We would have to put aside 100 years of case law. The legislators have, by their inactivity, basically nodded their heads at the opinions that have been given in the past. The opinions in Carter versus Van Meter, by the legislators not changing the statute, they basically have agreed with the court's interpretation of the wrongful death statute, and that is that when the sole surviving beneficiary dies, her estate or his estate does not inherit that cause of action.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Monk's here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Tell me who Ms. Monk's here.
That's the sister of Irene Preston. That's the sole remaining heir to the estate.
Do you agree that you are no longer asserting a survival claim in strict sense?
Yes,
and you only have a wrongful death claim at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. I thought about it at the time that we filed the appeal. This was the course of action that I felt was most prudent for my clients. The real point is that for the Wrongful Death Act to work, the estate of the beneficiary should be able to bring the cause of action. What does that mean in Irene Preston's case? Very simply, she has a cause of action for the damages under the Wrongful Death Act that accrued to her for 5 years and 7 months until she died. And the plaintiff will bear the burden of proving by competent evidence what those damages are, if any.
Do you think the court ought to be concerned with the difficulty in proof in a case like this where the damages are once removed, or actually twice removed, I guess, since there's a claim made for the death, and then also the damages sustained by the statutory beneficiary that are then attempted to be proved by a third party removed, actually, from the damaging event? Is that a concern?
For the court, Your Honor, the real concern for the court, for the state of Texas, is that a wrongful defendant is going to get to walk without even a trial on the merits.
But how is the jury going to be presented with the information necessary to make a proper determination in fairness to all parties?
Your Honor, this is a perfect case to make that point. Irene Preston was brain damaged at death and was, for all intents and purposes, lay terms, retarded. She couldn't make the proof on her case herself. She couldn't testify on her behalf. We had a psychologist do a psychological evaluation. And once again, the plaintiff is confronted with the proof problems you have in every case. If you don't have enough proof, you're not going to make your case.
If you've got proof problems as you would have in every case times two or three, this is a difficult case to present facts, I guess, isn't it?
Your Honor, if this court reverses, I've got to go try a case with nothing but dead people as my client.
So how do you do that?
It's tough, but it's a far different matter than saying that the defendant's going to walk scot-free just because people die. And that's the real point. That's the real logic. That's the real equity.
What is your burden here, counsel? If you got to take this case to trial, you'd have to establish, number one, the applicability of the Wrongful Death Act, that there was liability under the Wrongful Death Statute, and then some measure of damages to this woman's estate for the injury she suffered as a consequence of that wrongful death, which was a period of, what, about 6 years or so?
Five years and 7 months.
You have to come up with some really tough evidence about the monetary measure of the extent of her injuries as a consequence of this wrongful death to establish the damages to which her estate is entitled.
I'm glad to hear the court talking about the practical side of it, because that's right where I'd like to be. And these are all very practical questions.
Well, let me ask another one. I could dig around in the law and figure this out, but in what capacity is your surviving client here this month? Is she here as the administrator of her sister's estate, or is she here as
an heir? As an heir, Your Honor. That's all that it is. She's nothing more than a figurehead. The damages have to do with Irene Preston, and they're limited to the period of time from Alonzo Preston's death until the time of her death. Realize that we were on the brink of trial. It was April the 30th, and trial was to be on June the 25th. And in this case, all of the evidence was fully developed.
Is Ms. Monks Ms. Preston's only heir?
That is her only heir at this time. That's correct.
Is there an administrator or executor of the estate?
What the statute's note, to answer your question, Your Honor, what the statute says is heir or legal representative to the estate. And because we were hard-pressed at the time, we filed our suggestion of death and named the two sisters as heirs. Not as plaintiffs, not as claimants under the Act, but solely to pursue the claim of Irene Preston, who died on the brink of trial.
Go ahead.
I think your opposing counsel has already conceded in response to a question from the other end of the bench, whether it's concession or just an acceptance of the reality, that Irene Preston had lived long enough to get a final judgment against the city. Damages were awarded to her. She died the next day, and her recovery would become a part of her estate and would be distributed by the laws to set distribution to her heirs. If you had gone to trial and Irene had died the day before judgment, according to present case law, her suit would abate and nothing would survive to her estate. Is that the situation you're trying to rectify and the one that the city, I think, concedes exists right now? She died a day after judgment, there was a recovery for her estate. If she died the day before judgment, there is no recovery for her estate.
And the real point is that a defendant walks for fortuitous and capricious circumstances.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Marshall will now prove adjournment court.